Hey guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Seems like only 24 hours ago I was saying the same thing. Here I am again. All right. So you may or may not be able to hear. I'm not sure. I have a grackle. I guess that's probably a dove co-hosting the show here. Lots of birds around my house. It's because of the trees, I think. That's where they live, the birds. Sometimes they talk on my radio show. Hope you don't mind. Some people like it. I've got an email saying, I like the birds on your show, man. It's a nice kind of thing. Makes it sound like you're broadcasting from the woods. All right. Rats. All right. Hey, check it out. So yesterday, after the show, I recorded one with our friend Adam Morrow. Remember him? Formerly with IPS News. I guess he isn't doing much journalisming these days, except coming on my show, but that's all right anyway. So we talked about all kinds of stuff, man. He's living in Cairo, keeping score on the fascist military dictatorship there. And so I'm going to play that interview for you, and I think that you'll like it. Let's see. So Con Hallinan said no. Jim Bamford said no. William Astore said no. That's three no's. And that still leaves us with a couple no answers. Hey, guests, say yes, please. Oh, Scott McConnell also said no. He said, I can't do it, man. I just can't do it. I'm sorry. Which brings me to my first subject on the show today. Oh, right after I say this, go to my website, scotthorton.org. Listen to the archives there. There's 3,700 interviews going back to, you know, in the past. And also you can join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. Okay, so I got an email this morning from a longtime friend of the show, Bob. Hey, Bob! And so Bob was saying he's reading Jacob Hellbrun's book, They Knew They Were Right, which I read part of and then put down. I am so bad. I need to take a whole summer somehow. I need to win the lottery and just... I'm like that guy in the Twilight Zone. Just need some peace and quiet so I can get some time to read. I have so many books to catch up on, especially ones like that that I started. You know, there's this one called Genocide in Iraq that was really good and I only got to like page two. I heard from the guys behind that book the other day, you know. Oh, man, I started to read your book, but then I didn't finish it. Sorry, I suck at that. Anyway, so Jacob Hellbrun, he wrote a book called They Knew They Were Right, and it's all about the neocons. And one thing that happens on this show is somehow I get the mentality that the people who are listening are all like Bob, have been listening for years and know all of this stuff already, when, of course, there are a lot of new people, and then again, people listening for a long time, too. It doesn't mean that they necessarily heard shows where these kinds of things were necessarily tackled in detail. So, who and what are the neocons? That can be answered a lot of ways. My favorite definition, first of all, it's a biographical definition. It's not just an ideological one. Like, a neoliberal, that's basically anybody who's a center-left Democrat, right? For that matter, even moderate Republican types. Clintonian, Bill Clintonian, sort of, you know, what he calls free markets and democracy. American-led imperialism, mostly, but with that kind of softer core on it. But that could count for a lot of people. It's just basically anybody who believes in that. The neoconservatism is not the opposite of neoliberalism. It's virtually the same thing as far as policy goes. But really, it's not as much of an ism as it is a biographical designation of a bunch of guys, mostly Jews and Catholics, who were, you know, basically, as Hellbrun writes, I think, and really makes this clear, they were on the outside of the establishment. They weren't allowed in. They didn't have any, you know, real political power where it counts. And so they made their own establishment. They said, you know what, if you Rockefellers have the Council on Foreign Relations, we're just going to create 100 of them. And so that's where we got the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs and the Project for a New American Century. And, of course, you know, neocon takeover at which I don't know, maybe they were always there at the American Enterprise Institute, and then there's the Center for Security Policy, and there's 100 of them. And so they just kind of made their own establishment. And then, as Andrew Coburn puts it, the neoconservative movement really came together as a real solid movement, kind of, in the late 70s, as the cross between the Israel lobby and the military-industrial complex. Because the new right, as they call it, that grew up after World War II, they needed their own eggheads, right? The bankers and the oil men, you know, basically the Morgans and then the Rockefellers, they had the Council on Foreign Relations to come up with all the excuses for their imperialism, basically, right? The rationalizations for what they're doing. Well, Lockheed and Northrop and those guys, the new right that grew up on government money after World War II, they needed their own think tanks to get their own policies through, basically. And so they made this alliance with the neoconservatives. And this is, I think, best illustrated in at your easy access to Richard Cummings in his great article, Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, which was originally published in Playboy.com, but you can find it at CorpWatch.org, and you can also find it at my site under the Fair Use section there at ScottHorton.org. It's by Richard Cummings, and it's about how virtually all of the top neocons in the Bush Jr. administration, especially the first Bush Jr. administration, were all tied to Lockheed one way or the other, either working directly for them as some kind of lobbyist or collecting huge payoffs from them at their think tanks. Stephen Hadley was the one least connected to Lockheed, and he was a lawyer for a law firm that represented Lockheed, and pretty much like exclusively, and I think he worked on the Lockheed cases even, kind of thing. So they were all just the, you know, where Lockheed meets Israel payoffs and excuses for expansion. And so anyway, that's skipping ahead a bit, but it's just, you know, illustrates the way Andrew Coburn phrased it, basically, where the military-industrial complex meets the Israel lobby. And then ideologically, of course, they go back to Leon Trotsky. Now, Leon Trotsky, of course, was the co-founder of the Soviet Union. He was partners with Vladimir Lenin in the October coup of 1917 and was the founder of the Red Army. But then after Lenin died, he had the big split with Stalin, and Stalin, of course, won and took over the USSR and chased Trotsky out of there. And ended up murdering him, having an agent murder him down there in, was it in Mexico or somewhere else in South America? I forget now. But anyway, yeah, pickaxe to the ear hole. But anyway, so Trotsky had the big following from, or a big following from American communists because he was supposedly the more reasonable one, unlike Stalin or that kind of thing. And so, and then also, since he was anti-Stalin and they were Americans, they could be communists but still pro-America by being Trotskyites. So that was kind of part of that allure too. And then, of course, with the dawn of the Cold War, all of the trendiness of American communism was basically gone after the end of World War II. And so you had a whole lot of the first generation of Trotskyite communists start to come to the right. And that's Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz, and for that matter, Leo Strauss and Albert Wolfstetter at the University of Chicago. And then you also had William F. Buckley at the National Review. He couldn't find any real conservatives to be hardcore pro-Cold War because they were too conservative for that, the conservatives. So he ended up finding a bunch of ex-communists. Whitaker Chambers, the guy who famously testified against Alger Hiss, he was one of them. And then Sidney Hook and Frank Burnham. And, I used to be better at remembering all these names, all these writers from the National Review. And so the National Review basically became an outpost of these ex-communists turned right-wingers as long as they'd support the Cold War. And so then, that was the first generation of them. And now I got to go to this break. But when we get back, I'll talk a little bit more about the 70s and Scoop Jackson and then Ronald Reagan and then Iraq War II. And the neocons. Ooh, which brings us to current events, too. Jeb Bush. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, so... yeah, Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago, he was an ex-Trotskyite, and so was Albert Wolfstetter. And they both became the teachers of a great many of the neocons, including Wolfowitz and Pearl and Zalmay Khalilzad and, And then, you have the, Justin Raimondo would make a big point about the Shachmanites. There was a Trotskyite named Max Shachman, who then became, and I guess a lot like James Burnham, went from Trotskyite to kind of middle-of-the-road, managerial, technocratic tyranny type of a THX-1138 sort of regime of expertise kind of a guy. And he had his followers, too, and they were basically part of the Social Democrats USA, which you can trace... Max Boot and Joshua Moravchik and Gene Kirkpatrick and all different parts of the neoconservative movement to that group. And so now in Bob's question that he emailed me this morning, he said, the best I can tell about this, it's a social group, basically. Jim Loeb has an article, All in the Neocon Family, and it's actually about Victoria Nuland, Robert Kagan's wife, and how all of these people are related to Gertrude Himmelfarb, somehow, whatever, I forget. I think that was Irving Kristol's wife. I get these things confused. But Jim Loeb points out, you could basically fit most of all the neocons at one big Thanksgiving dinner, and it's all basically one big intermarried family of former communists and at least former Democrats. There are exceptions, like William Kristol. He was raised to be the spitting image of his father after his father was already, moved to the right and was no longer a communist. So Bill Kristol himself was never a communist to move to the right. He's, as far as I can tell, always been exactly what he is now. But he still gets to be a neocon because he's Irving Kristol's son. And even though he wasn't personally a former commie, he's, of that next generation. And then so you have the neoconservative writers at the National Review and the Weekly Standard and the Washington Post. Oh, I need to go back to Bob. What Bob was saying. It seems like a social clique more than an ideology, right? Libertarians, we have principles. There are things that we believe, and you can define us. Even if you hate us, you can tell who we are by the things that we're against and this kind of stuff. But he says the neocons, they kind of seem all over the place, or at least, policies or beliefs don't seem to be their organizing factor, right? And, of course, that omits Israel. And money. And so that's really their organizing principle more than anything else. And this is illustrated quite well in this article. Oh, man, don't tell me I closed this one out. No, here it is. It's at MondoWeiss.net, and it's about this guy, Brahman. And I don't know if he's a neocon or not. He seems to be just a rich right-wing Zionist. And this is about how he's given all this money to Rubio, and so Rubio is as bad as he can possibly be on Israel, that kind of thing. And but the point I wanted to get to is not just his quote where he says it's so important. This guy puts Israel first. It's so important to keep America as the global power, as an empire, because America must be strong to protect Israel. Right? Not to protect the American people, but to protect Israel. And I don't necessarily think that that's right, that Israel needs America to survive. Maybe under current circumstances with the indefinite occupation and all of that kind of thing. Maybe under their horrible policies. But here's the real point is that as Phil Weiss, or I'm sorry, it's his co-author here, I guess, writes, that statement is very reminiscent of the neoconservative founders, Norman Podhoretz and Irving Kristol, saying they left the Democratic Party in the 70s because a weak U.S. military posed a direct threat to Israel. That belief is the neoconservative creed, and it's why they support U.S. wars. Now, that's a little bit oversimplified at the end there, but no, pretty much, yeah. So, obviously, the admirals and the generals, they all like having a world empire and collecting stars on their chests and giant pensions, and the military-industrial complex has their interest. And, of course, the neocons as individuals, again, they're all, look at, every single one of them is fat. All of them living high on the hog on think tank money. And no offense, fat people, but I mean, look at the Kagans. These people are, that's not, you know, they just have husky builds. They are gluttons on, you know, what amounts to American taxpayer money, right? Laundered through Lockheed and other like firms. And so that's their interest. And, you know, we're at a point now, of course, skipping ahead again to current day, of ultimate absurdity, where they are pretending that America and Israel are completely aligned. No daylight. No daylight, as Joe Biden, our vice president, says, when, as they put it, their policy is that in the massive sectarian civil war raging across the Middle East right now, that they prefer the Sunnis to the Shiites. And yes, even if that means the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda in Syria, and or the Islamic State. Because the other guys are backed by Iran. Except Iran isn't really our enemy. All they ever did to us was overthrow our sock puppet fascist dictator that we had ruling their country, which they had every right to do. Now, the hostage thing, that was ugly, but still, that was 40 years ago almost, guys. So get over it. Certainly nothing to fight about. And when it comes to our actual enemies in the region, they're Iran's enemies too. And that doesn't mean that we should ally with Iran against them, but it certainly means that it's absolutely crazy to say that America's interests and Israel's interests are the same when they are, in fact, diametrically opposed. And in fact, so here's that clip I played yesterday. Here's one another example, you know, to the nth degree here, not Syria, but Iran itself, Norman Podhoretz. Oh, if this thing will ever play right when I hit it.
Well, if we were to bomb the Iranians, as I hope and pray we will, it will unleash a wave of anti-Americanism all over the world that will make the anti-Americanism we've experienced so far look like a love fest. On the other hand, excuse me, that's a worst-case scenario.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, that's a worst-case scenario. In fact, probably everybody will love us if we bomb Iran and everything will work out great. Now, here's Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, you know, if someone's got to, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
Mm-hmm. And of course, his excuses are all the casualties are on Assad, even the ones on his side, and Iran's making nuclear bombs. And that's why we got to support the Islamic State and Nusra, really? Yep. From Israel's point of view, Oren said. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, guys, welcome back. So, yeah, man, I hate to say this, but there's an article by David Korn that you might want to look at. No, don't throw rocks at me! Wait! I know I just pissed everybody off. David Korn! Get a rope! The thing about it is the article, it's on antiwar.com today, man. I gave it the thumbs up to run. Because it's about Lori Milroy. You remember her? All through the 1990s, she was the lady who was saying that Ramzi Youssef, the World Trade Center bomber who was called in to replace the undercover FBI informant after they pulled him off the case, and blew up that building. Lori Milroy decided that he was not really Ramzi Youssef, the Baluchi terrorist, Al-Qaeda friend of Osama. A friend of Egyptian Islamic Jihad. No, it wasn't him. It was a member of Saddam Hussein's Mukhabarat who went undercover and killed a man and stole his identity and then from his identity stole Ramzi Youssef's identity. Nobody ever knows what really happened to the real Ramzi Youssef. But now the man everybody believes is Ramzi Youssef is really a secret agent of Saddam Hussein pretending to be Ramzi Youssef. And it's the worst of hackery and ridiculous crap. It's just not true, not by a long shot. And David Korn has this article about how, but guess who pushed this thing? Paul Wolfowitz. And he neglected to mention Judy Miller, and even Lynn Cheney actually had signed a blurb endorsing Saddam Hussein's unfinished war with the United States. And according to Milroy, not only, and I think that this is debunked, but it's a two-parter. Not only did Terry Nichols go to the Philippines and learn how to make truck bombs there somehow, possibly from Ramzi Youssef, which I think does not hold water. J.D. Cash never thought it did, and I'm with him. But that, again, Ramzi Youssef was not Al-Qaeda. He was, or at least Al-Qaeda is all just a front for Iraqi intelligence, she claimed. So, and then as David Korn explains, all through the embassy attacks, so First World Trade Center, Oklahoma City, and then I guess probably Khobar Towers, the Africa embassies, the USS Cole, she was convinced that all of this was Saddam Hussein's doing. And I'm not sure to what degree she was just an outright liar. I remember hearing her on the Carl Wigglesworth show seeming like she really believed this crap, but I don't know. But anyway, so Paul Wolfowitz either believed it or boy did he want to believe it or boy did he want other people to believe it. Even though the FBI and the CIA absolutely debunked it and disavowed it over and over again and military intelligence and whatever the rest. And it was also, as David Korn points out, Paul Wolfowitz's hobby horse, among others, including Douglas Feith over in the Pentagon. Oh, yeah, he was also in the Pentagon with Wolfowitz. That they really tried their best to push this myth that Mohammed Atta, the lead 9/11 hijacker, was seen meeting with the head of Iraqi intelligence in Prague in the Czech Republic. And it was a bunch of crap, and it never was true, but he was, you know, the guy who wanted to push that the most. And so David Korn's point is, and then Jeb Bush is bragging that Wolfowitz is one of his foreign policy advisors. Now, that might sound mysterious to you and me, that, boy, don't he know how bad that looks? But the thing is, to who? It's your false assumption there's some kind of democracy going on here, and that it's your impression that matters. What matters is Sheldon Adelson's impression. What matters is the people with the power that run the power factions, that control the consensus, or at least, you know, work very hard to control the consensus among the power factions. What do they think and what do they want? And which of them matter the most? Which of them are going to be pleased to see Wolfowitz's name and which will be repulsed? when Jeb got in trouble for saying that George W. Bush would be his advisor, and everybody said, oh my God, I can't believe you said that. Here's how he walked it back. He said, no, just on Israel and Palestine, I mean. Because he was in New York giving a talk to Jewish donors and saying, well, when it comes to Israel and Palestine, I'm going to turn to my brother. Because of the talking point being that his brother aimed to please and never did really disappoint, other than that he didn't bomb Iran, I guess, but they felt he was reliable enough, and so that was something that Jeb had said in his statement. But yeah. Anyway, what the hell was I going to say about that? Oh yeah, Jeb. It's the power factions that choose. And I think it's amazing how poorly Jeb is doing. I mean, I would think that if there's one thing about him, it would have to be that he would have people around him really trying hard to help him practice this stuff. They asked him about knowing it, and you're familiar with this now, it's kind of the popular political story right now. Knowing what we know now, would you still support the war? And he said, oh yeah, he went, and it shows how dim he is, right? He went to his practice talking point that he didn't practice that well. But that's part of the problem of having talking points instead of real knowledge and views is they come out all ham-handed and in the wrong context. So the question was, knowing what we know now, and he answered, if I'd been in George's position then, would I have done it too? And so he doesn't want to throw his brother under the bus and whatever, whatever. But meanwhile, the knowing what we know now answer, well, that's okay to say already in Republican circles that, for many of them anyway, that, well, look, knowing what we know now, that's different. But at the time, right, you could make a great pro-W spin out of that. Listen, at the time, who was a real scary blah, 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 right? Give him some crap. But instead, Jeb completely blew it. And then as someone tweeted me this morning, haha, his blunder on this question has now made it a follow-up for all the rest of the candidates. Rand came out and says, I think it was bad even at the time. Marco Rubio says, knowing what we know now, we shouldn't have done it. So now this is a real matter of debate in this campaign. I think it's interesting. I still hold to my Jeb Bush is going to be the next president thing because of, just how powerful his family is and how connected they are to the rest of the establishment. How much trust the rest of the establishment has in the Bush family brand, I think, and his centrism, frankly. I mean, that's what makes him supposedly electable against Hillary Clinton. It's the same reason she'll be the nominee on the Democrat side, right? You know, all things being equal. It's possible. Jeb, he doesn't seem quite as stupid as W, but that's a really low bar, okay? A really low bar. And Jeb seems pretty stupid. You know, Bush, the father, was known that I had a calendar of George Bushisms back before W was even a thing. Of all the idiotic things, it wasn't just Dan Quayle. It was his president, George H.W. Bush, said completely ridiculous crap all the time, too. And so anyway, they're not so much a bright bunch, these Bushes. And so it's still possible for Jeb to blow it. But so far, I'm not changing my bet yet. I don't think he's blown it fully yet. But it's interesting to see. It's just on the surface, stupid political way. It's kind of interesting to see them fight about this. And I hope they have to fight about it some more. And I wish Rand Paul would go ahead and get tough and start cracking jokes at Jeb's expense. I mean, I still don't think he can win the nomination. But if he wants to try, the obvious talking point here is that Jeb ought to be Hillary's running mate. Hardy har har har. And what's Jeb going to say about that? Yeah, Jeb said it himself. He's exactly like Hillary on everything. And how's he ever going to live that down? How's Jeb ever going to live that down? He ought to be running for vice president on Hillary Clinton's ticket. It has all the sexism built in and everything. It's perfect for conservatives. But that means that Rand needs to be ready to fight. Yeah, let me tell you why it was stupid even way back then. And he has to not have talking points, right? He has to have his real knowledge of the situation that why he knew better then. And he knew better then because his father knew better then and said so well. You can go to antiwar.com and read Ron Paul's 35 questions that aren't being asked about Iraq. You can read his speech that he gave on the House floor in opposition to the war. Oh, man, I meant to talk more about the neocons. Hey, look this up. You want to know about the neocons in the Bush administration? Go to 16 articles, and my name's Scott Horton. You'll find it. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's true. All right, coming up in just a second, I'm going to play this Adam Morrow clip for you. But let me just say real quick. I don't know. This is going to end up taking a while. It's always sabotage when I promise to be brief, isn't it? So what would Jim Loeb say? Jim Loeb would say, hey, Bob, so the deal is this, man. The neocons, they were mostly still leftists until 67. And that was kind of a big watershed. The summer of love and the rise of the new left anti-war, anti-Vietnam, anti-militarism in general kind of generation, and the 67 war in Israel that led them to, as I was quoting from Mondo Weiss there, Podhoretz and Crystal and these guys deciding that they were going to abandon the left because militarism was far more important to them than any other supposed liberal or left-wing shibboleth, I guess. So, and then, you know, they actually became kind of allies with the libertarians in a way because they became against the welfare state and that kind of thing. And they come from the same social class, right? Libertarianism was mostly founded by upper-middle-class intellectual Jews and Catholics, too. And a lot of these guys all knew each other and were friends, only the libertarians are sort of the mirror opposite of the neocons, where they're extremists for everything. We're extremists against everything and, of course, eschew power. And so they're happy to take it up. They don't give a damn. In fact, they'll do anything they can to obtain it. And so many of the more important household names in terms of government, neocons in government, went to work for Scoop Jackson, Henry Jackson. He was the senator from Washington State. They called him the senator from Boeing because that's whose interest he served. And he was a right-wing, hawkish Democrat on all things Soviet Union and all things Israel. And Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, and I'm not sure, I forget now, which all of the neocons went to work for him. It was quite a few of them. And then throughout the 70s, they made more and more alliances on the right, including with the supply-siders like Jude Winiski. And it was Jude, actually, who introduced Richard Perle to Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney, of course, represented at the time the rise of the right-wing nationalists inside what had been the Rockefellers' Republican Party. And so that was how that alliance was born, and Jude apologized for that later. He was a good guy, man, for a monetarist. Very, very good on war. Became a paleocon later. He was a neo-paleocon like Scott McConnell, right? A former neocon turned paleocon, Jude Winiski. But anyway, so then in the Reagan administration, a bunch of these guys got jobs as the deputy assistant secretary of this and that in the State Department and the Defense Department and on the National Security Council. And that's Elliot Abrams and Wolfowitz and Perle. And I think Gaffney was never confirmed by the Congress, but he must have done something. He sure does claim that he was the assistant secretary of some crap, although Gordon Prather says he never really was. And so there's, you know, I don't know, maybe a dozen or so of these guys have pretty prominent positions, third and fourth tier positions in the Reagan administration. And then George H.W. Bush, and Reagan kept them out of Middle Eastern affairs, right? They were allowed to persecute people in Latin America, but Reagan kept them away from the Middle East, and so did George Bush Sr. And Sr. And his counterparts, Scowcroft and Baker, his national security advisor and bestest friend, Scowcroft, and James Baker, who I believe they are very close personal friends and was also his Secretary of State. They called these guys the crazies in the basement. And they're, for whatever reason, I guess we have to please them and let them into our administration. But they are to only, you know, club little Nicaraguan babies to death or whatever, but they're not to touch Middle East policy. But then comes the junior administration after the year 2000, and these guys had been, you know, nesting at their project for a new American century, putting out their studies, their letters to Clinton demanding more war, and especially against Iraq, rebuilding America's defenses, claiming America ought to conquer the whole planet and all those kinds of things. Oh, I should mention, Wolfowitz, Libby, and Khalilzad all worked together on the defense planning guidance of 1991 after the first Gulf War, which, you know, basically stated the Wolfowitz doctrine. We will accept no near-peer competitor, and we will launch preemptive war against any threat that we think might ever become a threat, and this kind of thing. And then, so in the 90s, they sat at their think tanks, and then in the junior administration, they just came right in. And as David Korn mentions in that article, talks about in that article, after September 11th, Wolfowitz immediately was on the warpath to try to pin the attack on Iraq, and or to at least somehow implicate Saddam Hussein in Al-Qaeda, and even had, as Korn writes, I really should have read Korn's book with Isikoff. There are some pretty good little factoids in there, apparently, that Wolfowitz actually gave the DIA a copy of Milroy's book and said, I want you guys to review this thing and check it out. And they just said, no, this is, sorry, boss, this does not hold up. But no matter, obsessed with getting Iraq because that was what the Likud party in Israel wanted. And they went for it. And so you had the Cheney network. You had Cheney and Rumsfeld were the best friends in the right wing, I guess best friends again. They had had a cooling off, according to Andrew Coburn's book, Rumsfeld. But they became buddies again, and then they were the bosses. And then under them, in the vice president's office, you had John Hanna and Harold Rode and David Addington. I don't think David Addington, he may not have been an ex-communist. Almost all these guys are ex-lefties of one kind or another. Addington, however, I think might have been just a long-time kind of right-wing royalist type. But then David Wurmser, who later moved to the vice president's office, he was with John Bolton at the State Department. Now, Bolton is another one of these guys. And Wurmser, I think, may have been trained by ex-communists rather than being an ex-communist himself. I think he was one of the Leo Strauss guys at the University of Chicago. But anyway, their job, Bolton was a lifelong Goldwater Republican, right-wing nationalist, not a neocon, but just best friends with all those guys. And so their job in the State Department was keeping a leash on Colin Powell and his buddy Dick Armitage. And then at the Defense Department, you had Richard Perle on the Defense Policy Board, along with Newt Gingrich, who I don't know if he was ever a left-winger, I don't think, but very close to these AEI guys. And I think James Woolsey was even on the Defense Policy Board. And then you had Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and then Douglas Feith, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy. And then under Douglas Feith, you had Elliot Abrams and Abram Shulsky and Michael Rubin and Michael Ledeen and, Bill Luddy, although he was a former military officer and I think not an ex-communist himself, just a fellow traveler. And I'm sorry because I know I'm leaving names out of the Office of Special Plans crew, but these were the guys. Oh, Michael Maloof, he joined with Feith to create what was called the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group. And before you go to sleep, that means they were in charge of coming up with pretending that Osama and Saddam were best buddies and pushing that myth in the lead up to the war. And so if you want to know all about how this happened, then all you need for keywords is my name, Scott Horton, and 16 articles, the numbers 1 and 6, 16 articles. And it's Dan Sanchez put this together from just some tweets that I put out on the anniversary. And it's actually 18 or 19 by the time you get to the end of it. and it's all of the best articles that I could think of that I remember about how the neocons lied us into war. And there's some really good ones there, and if you really want to know about who the neocons are and what they're up to and what they're about and how it is that they get away with the things that they do, et cetera, it's pretty much all there, you know? I'll probably kick myself one day when I think of more articles that should have belonged in here that somehow got miscategorized in my brain, but yeah, so there you go. Long story short, the neocons, they're Lockheed and the Likud Party's fifth column in the United States of America. That's who they are. And they're the guys that lied us into war with Iraq. Bob asked in his original question here about Trotsky's doctrines of global revolution and all that. Are these things really guiding principles of these guys? And, you know, it's interesting. I think it actually is. I've heard this attributed to them so many times that, you know, the permanent revolution, as Trotsky called it, is actually part of their thing. In fact, I have clips somewhere of Michael Ledeen talking about that. I don't know why they call us conservatives. Yes, we're absolutely radicals. Never stop. Turn the whole world into a boiling cauldron of change. And then I don't have time to talk about Strauss with you, but next time. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Okay, guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So I just wanted to point out about the reaction to Hirsch's article. You know, even Gareth Porter disagrees with him on some, pretty important aspects of the thing. I don't know whether the article is quite as solid as Hirsch thinks it is either, but... You notice when it came to the sarin thing, they mostly just tried to ignore it. Man, they didn't want to get into that. When Turkey and al-Nusra tried to frame up Assad for the sarin attack in 2013, and Hirsch later came out and explained what happened there. They just hoped that one would go away. With this one, it's just too much of an affront, as he explained in the interview here. It's too much of an affront to all the work that they've done being stenographers for power. We have a whole very... This isn't just a news story. Right, to you and me, come on. You can't fool us with this crap, right? We're all cynical about all this stuff no matter what. But to the people overall and to the people running the mainstream media, this is official Americana mythology here, right? This is like that time that we saved the world from the Japanese and the Germans. This is like that time that George Washington admitted that he chopped down the cherry tree and Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery and all this stuff, you know? So, we got bin Laden, and now you want to come and undermine not just an official American tale, but all of the talking points that these idiots regurgitated? Man, and they go after him so bad. Because he's undermining the civic religion, right? He's undermining the people's belief in the narrative of American national greatness. That the people with the power know that we need to have, to believe, so that we'll continue to give them power. USA, USA. Come on. The guy was at least hiding, maybe under, more likely, under house arrest there in the attic of some dump in the armpit of the planet Earth, as far as you can get from here without being on your way back again. But, boy, we need our idols. And somebody like Hirsch comes and knocks down stories, levels of myth on the order of what they did with the killing of bin Laden there. Boy, do they flip out. And by the way, did you guys see the thing in Slate? It's so funny, dude. You got to read this thing. It's, okay, so the guys at Slate, they ran all this stuff, you know, very hacky criticisms of Hirsch in this article, I thought. And then here they did an interview with him. And the title is, "I'm Not Backing Off Anything I Said, an Interview with Seymour Hirsch." And it's just great, dude. You just love it. Trust me, man. Go and read this thing. You'll laugh your ass off. I like Cy Hirsch, man. First of all, his denunciers, they all, whatever, I made that up, I think. They all say, well, you know, he got Mili and Abu Ghraib right, but other than that, yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I think he did a lot of really great stuff, including on Israel's Samson option, where they have threatened to nuke Rome and Paris and London and even D.C., Berlin, if the Western allies ever forsake them. Wow. I'm pretty sure that's a thing, dude. And then also, they're our best allies in the Middle East. A Western democracy, just like us. We love them. They love us. And then also, look at everything he did in the Bush years. In fact, two of the first ones on my list of the 16 are the stovepipe and selective intelligence about how the neocons lied us into war. They call themselves, self-mockingly, the cabal. And they're liars. The neocons. He's done a hell of a lot of great work. I like the guy, and so when he's cranking, he's screaming at the Slate guy. I'm on Hirsch's side. I think he's great. I think he's hilarious. Anyway, the whole point is, never even mind if whatever his senior intelligence official and other sources have said, whether they're spinning him and he got this one wrong or not. I don't know to what degree. I think it's very clear now that there definitely was a walk-in, not a courier, and that they spun that whole thing, which means they sure as hell were spinning your ass when they were saying torture led to the courier, when the courier was a figment of their propaganda and then your imagination. Maybe, you know, I'm not accusing you particularly, but you know what I mean. Everyone on the right repeated that mantra like the mainstream media. It's that confirmation bias. People love it. Whether in all the details or not, whether he got it right in all the details or not, to see them go after their better like this, all the media people, is, to me, it's hilarious. And to read his argument with this kook, whoever this guy is, in Slate, is, to me, the height of hilarity. I won't lie and say I was wiping tears from my eyes or anything like that, but it was pretty damn funny. Yeah, man. I liked it. All right, so yes, of course, I did blow this whole segment, but then, so for the rest of the show, coming up is going to be a great interview with Adam Morrow about America and Israel's sock puppet military dictatorship in Egypt. And I think you might want to listen to it. Oh, by the way, I guess I should end this segment just catching you up here a little bit on some things about, I didn't even realize this until the Jacob Sullum article. U.S. right to use cell phone location data in Florida case. Yeah, this is huge. This is federal appeals court has ruled they do not need a warrant to use your location data against you, which is the same. In other words, there's no exclusionary rule. In other words, go ahead, local cops, and just keep everybody's cell phone location data all the time. Not just the NSA, all the cops, local, state, federal, whoever. They can just have your location data all the time. Under the theory that if you make a contract with a business that would lead to them having your information, then you might as well have signed up to give all that data to the government too. Everybody knows that. Now, they never prove that. It doesn't make any sense on the face of it. The third party doctrine. It's just made up totalitarian nonsense. Well, is the phone company an agency of the government or isn't it? Ah, that's how they get you. See, live in a fascist state. It's a participatory fascism, as Robert Higgs says. But yeah, it is a fascist state, and the telephone company actually is an agency of the government, and how do you like that? It always has been. Anyway, third-party doctrine. In other words, every business on the planet is deputized by the U.S. government to collect information for them, and they don't need a warrant for any of it. For any business record on any individual. Not the business's record of them doing business with other businesses. Not even the record of whether you paid your bill on time, their business with their consumer. But who did the consumer call? Right? Who did they use their ISP to whose site, whose server did they surf? Because, hey, if you're doing it and it's a thing, then that automatically has no privacy to go with it. Why would you ever think that it does? No expectation of privacy, they claim. Anyway, they passed the USA Freedom Act as well, which basically, I guess the amendments to it or however it's written, it reauthorizes Section 215 of the Patriot Act for continued abuse. And yes, abuse, because as a federal appeals court ruled last week, and obviously correctly, there's just no real argument about it, the government's formerly secret, thank you, Edward Snowden, interpretation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act is moot and illegal because it contradicts the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which is the ultimately superior law in this case. And to say that all records may at some point be relevant to an investigation and therefore the government has a right to all records is absolutely crazy, they ruled. And so, don't you love the U.S. Congress? One week after the court says hell no, the Congress, at least the House, they reauthorize what the court said is patently unconstitutional, against the Bill of Rights, a violation of your rights.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, introducing Adam Morrow, friend of the show, living in Cairo, Egypt, and he's a journalist, at least some of the time. And has at least in the past written a lot for Interpress Service, and ever since the Arab Spring broke out at the beginning of 2011, he's really been my go-to guy, above all others when it comes to what the hell is going on over in the American territory of Egypt these days. So, welcome back to the show, Adam. Good to have you on.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Good. Very happy to have you here. So, first of all, I wanted to talk about this story in the Daily Beast. I'm not sure if you've seen this piece, but I know you're familiar with the topic here. Secret tapes of the 2013 Egypt coup, of the coup plot, pose a problem for Obama, is the headline here at the Daily Beast. And, you know, of course, this is about the American politics of it, where they're trying to pretend this is not a coup, right? Our Secretary of State, in 2013, when the military overthrew the elected government there, the post-Arab Spring government, he said, well, this is the restoration of democracy. And that's their loophole, is that they're just pretending that black is white, basically. And yet these leaked tapes, you know, make that pretense pretty hard to keep up, I guess, is the basis of this. But I was just hoping, you know, first of all, you could just tell us as much as you could about the tapes. Who leaked them? Do you know what all is in them and what all it means for Egyptian politics?
Sure, sure. The implications on the U.S. scene, I'm not really following too closely, but I can tell you from the Egyptian side that these leaks have been coming out every couple of weeks for the past couple of months. It started shortly after the coup, but they've sort of picked up in sort of intensity and the intensity of their content. And they're usually published or they're usually introduced by either Gezira, the Qatari-owned news network, or pro-brotherhood satellite television stations that have sort of cropped up in the wake of the 2013 coup that broadcast mainly from Turkey. One of the big questions is the content varies. First of all, the content varies. I mean, there's different stuff that implicates the judicial system. There was one several months ago in which you had different military officials sort of talking about how they were going to fix something or spin some lie in order to justify, if you remember, Mohamed Morsi, who was the democratically elected president, who was imprisoned after the 2013 coup. The tape revealed how the judiciary figures were playing around with terms and that sort of thing, and basically trying to cover up the fact that the man was being illegally imprisoned, that there was no justification for his imprisonment, but that he was being held anyway. That was one of them. There have been other recent ones in which Egyptian officials, including Sisi himself, I believe, are sort of talking in derisive terms about the Gulf rulers and how money should be forthcoming to Egypt, how desperately they needed Gulf money to basically fund the country's faltering economy. And they speak very sort of derisively about the Gulf rulers, to the point where I think Sisi actually issued an official apology to Qatar because he was taped insulting the Qatari emir's mother, which, as you can imagine, in the Arab world is a big deal. So you basically had these string of embarrassments that have been ranged from financial to judicial, to judicial misdealings, to all sorts of things that have implicated Sisi and implicated the coup authorities. And one of the major questions also is it's not just the content of these leaked tapes, but it's how they were obtained. A lot of people are saying, how is it possible that at the highest levels of government, can be infiltrated or how is it possible? Yeah, go ahead.
Compromised is the word you're looking for.
Compromised is the word I'm looking for. Exactly. Yeah. And again, at the highest levels of government, I mean, we're talking about personal conversations that the president himself is having with the top brass. That's one of the big questions is just, it sort of points to incompetence.
Right. Yeah. So tons of scandals in here. I think it's notable. I can't help but point out the detail of the one where they, as they put it in this Daily Beast article, they held Morsi in the wrong jail after the coup d'etat and the kidnapping. If only they had taken him to a civilian jail, they could get away with that. But now here they are caught on tape saying, no, you idiot, you shouldn't have taken him to a military jail because that's illegal. And that might end up, as they put it here, that might end up with him having to be released. And I just thought, isn't that funny? Because, of course, in America, you take Jose Padilla, where they turned him over to Donald Rumsfeld and George Tenet, the military custody, to be CIA tortured. And then they just turned around and indicted him and put him in prison anyway in the civilian court system. And there was no question here in the heart of the empire that the fact that he had been held illegally would somehow make his further trial and conviction and imprisonment null and void. But here, that's how it is in Egypt. They got a more of a rule of law there. And admittedly, he is, an elected president who's been deposed here, so maybe that's a little bit different. But it just seems like in America, the law was never really the question in that case. You know what I mean? Whether they could prosecute him again that was never a question, but it seems to be one here.
Right. Well, what's for certain is that the content of these leaks is, I mean, it is damning. I mean, I can't remember all of them. You know, there have been at least half a dozen major ones over the course of the last 6 months, and they're all really, really damning. I mean, these guys are really caught red-handed, committing criminal acts. Mm-hmm.
And now CeCe had already kind of, I mean, we all remember, regular listeners to this show certainly remember your coverage in the lead-up to the coup with the kind of big fake Tahrir Square, kind of copycat, pseudo Tahrir Square protest, where they used that as the excuse to overthrow the government. But they didn't really have that kind of public support like the 2011 revolution. They just tried to make it look like it in an imposterish kind of way. And I guess, you know, we talked about the Muslim Brotherhood certainly had their problems when they were in power, you know, being able to effectively govern or even making wise choices in their attempts to govern. But it seems like if he ever had any kind of popularity, it's long gone. It was, what, a year ago or more? When was a year and a half ago when they held the election where he got like 2% even turned out to pretend to give him a rubber stamp on his coup and his legitimacy and power? I just wonder, you know, is he just, you know, George Bush in 2008 here with no public support whatsoever at this point? Or how bad is it?
How bad is it? Yeah, well, we've talked about this in the past. After the initial euphoria that came in the immediate wake of the coup, where the media was trying to push this image that everybody in the country was entirely behind what's happened, and in fact, millions of Egyptians did buy into it. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to downplay the size of the 2013 protest that led to Morsi's ouster. I mean, it was big. There's no getting around the fact that it was big, but that was only because there was a concerted media push for months before that, pushing Egyptians of all stripes to hit the streets. So I think a lot of people were just answering these calls by the media.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
So they were big. I mean, the 2013 protests were big, but they were also exaggerated. The size of them was exaggerated.
Well,
I mean,
they weren't necessarily
33 million people.
Well, they weren't all necessarily calling for the military to cancel the results of the elections either, were they?
They were calling for what initially started as calls for a re-election, which was ludicrous because they, you know, the guy had only been in power for 1 year. You know, so they were what initially started as calls for a simple re-election quickly became demands for Morsi's ouster. I mean, as the hysteria heightened in the days leading up to the in the days leading up to the protest and the eventual coup. But that's a good point. I mean, a lot of sort of liberal people out there who joined the protests weren't expecting the military to step in. You know, people were sort of expecting Morsi would be forced to step down and that fresh democratic elections would be held. They didn't think that the military was going to come in and just, you know, lock everything down for the next several months and then have a pro forma election in which Sisi would win 97% of the vote. So that did come as a surprise to everybody, or at least to, you know, the sort of more idealistic people that might have joined the protests. As for waning popularity, that initial euphoria is long gone. I mean, I would say 6 months ago, it was long gone, because basically we have Egypt is suffering from the same pressures. It's facing the exact same pressures that it suffered that led people to hit the streets in early 2011. You know, when the Arab Spring began, poverty remains the same. You know, the rampant unemployment. You know, the lack of development, poor infrastructure. So you've got all these economic motivations that are still there. You know, nothing has been solved. So those pressures still exist. His popularity is definitely sunk, and he's now basically now it's down to sort of a small core of supporters. But a lot of that, you know, floating middle You know, a lot of that, a lot of that big silent majority has probably gone from initial support based on based on media, to a disillusionment and the realization that actually, you know, nothing is going to change. And I think he's come out recently saying things like, you know, Egypt needs at least another 10 years before change can be felt, and that sort of thing. So people are sort of realizing that it was kind of a hoax, you know, that it was kind of a trick, and that Egypt just finds itself in exactly the same situation that it was before the initial popular uprising in January 2011.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like that small core of support is the officer corps, and that's really what counts, right?
Yeah, officer corps and their families and their circle, possibly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, but again, also you don't forget you also have the media pumping out a steady diet of pro-government propaganda, and unfortunately, you know, people from outside looking at that, or maybe the more sophisticated viewers watch that and they laugh at the silly government propaganda. But what people have to realize is that there are tens of millions of you know, simple Egyptian folk living, you know, down the you know, down the Nile Valley, you know, farmers and things like this, who buy into this stuff. This is their only source of information in many cases. So there are tens of millions of Egyptians out there who see this stuff and buy into it. You know, believe that Egypt is under attack by terrorists, and what Sisi did was basically rescue the country from the clutches of an evil Muslim Brotherhood that was bent on, you know, dominating everything and would refuse to relinquish power even if it lost elections in the future. And mm-hmm. So a lot of people have bought into this stuff, unfortunately. But that being said, you know, the lack of change is making people realize that, you know, they're still in the exact same situation that they were 3 years ago. Whether or not that will translate into any kind of popular movement remains to be seen, though, because the level of repression now is so tremendous. You know, it's like what happened in January of 2011 really gave the regime here, or the deep state, what's popularly referred to as the deep state, really gave them the shock of their lives. You know, that really caught them by surprise, caught them with their pants down. And I think it really gave them like a psychological complex, to the point where at this point, they don't even want to see people. They don't want to see crowds of people under any circumstances. You know,
yeah,
they don't
want to
see crowds
of people. What about the psychology of the masses, though? I mean, don't they have such a taste of power? And wow, it turns out they really could have overthrown Mubarak all along. All they needed was the right spark to go out in the street and demand it, and he was done. Took them, what, 2 weeks? So how can they go back to the bad old days after that kind of victory?
Because they're afraid of live ammunition, you know? I mean, back in the for most of the 18 days, or for much of the 18 days, and certainly for a lot of the things that followed the revolution, a lot of the clashes and things like that followed the revolution, you security forces mainly relied on tear gas and birdshot, and only would resort to live ammunition, you know, or heavy ammunition as sort of like a last sort of resort sort of thing, whereas nowadays after the coup, I mean, they just come, that just starts with the live fire right off the bat. Forget about the tear gas. Forget about the birdshot. I mean, they're just shooting to kill from the get-go. Mm-hmm. So I mean, because, again, they are looking to completely cow the public. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they're taking no prisoners. They are making sure that what happened in early 2011 never, ever, ever happens again. Like, for example, I walk through Tahrir Square every day, and it's been converted largely to a parking lot. You know, they've built sort of parking lots and things like that, and I suspect they're changing the geography of the square, even to ensure that what happened in early 2011 can't be repeated.
Yeah, well, and of course we all remember, it shouldn't go without saying, though, that when they did the coup and they first came to power and arrested Morsi, that they murdered approximately 1,000 people in the streets of Cairo right then and there in the first few days, right?
They killed 1,000 people. Just to deliver the message, dissent would not be tolerated.
Yeah. So, now you might remember, I'm sure you do, that in the beginning, I'm going to say January or February would be my guess, of 2013, Phil Giraldi, a friend of the show, sponsor of the show, former CIA officer. He came on and said that his former and current and retired, and you know how they are, those CIA guys, his buddies were telling him that they knew that the Saudis were bankrolling rent-a-mobs in Cairo to try to agitate against the Muslim Brotherhood and soften the place up for the coup. And we had discussed that, and I, you know, you were never in a position to confirm the Saudi involvement there. That was Phil's story, but it does raise the question, and it seems like it's pretty openly talked about nowadays, Adam, that the Saudis are very much in with the Sisi regime and very much hated the Muslim Brotherhood and wanted to get rid of them. Even though we see, as you mentioned, Qatar, they support the Muslim Brotherhood and they're behind all these leaks, the publication of all these leaks there through Al Jazeera. You have the opposite stance by the Saudis. Is that it?
Yeah. Saudi is definitely leading the pack along with its friends, the United Arab Emirates. And Kuwait are definitely the main bankrollers and chief supporters of Sisi and the coup. So with that in mind, given everything that's happened subsequently, it makes perfect sense that they would have had people here on the ground actively bankrolling and organizing what would later turn into the June 30th demonstration that would culminate in Morsi's ouster. That makes perfect sense. And then if you look at Saudi now, how insanely activist it's become on foreign policy issues. I mean, just in the last 2 years alone, how it's gone after the Assad regime and funding all of these heavily armed opposition, so-called Islamist groups that are in opposition to Assad. If you look at the events in Yemen, the latest events in Yemen and the what Saudi is doing there, putting together an international air coalition to attack Yemen targets. They're talking about sending ground troops and things like this. I mean, Saudi has suddenly become an enormous player. And I think the idea is, I'm sure you've talked about this with other people, the idea is that, they feel that they've been let down by the United States because the U.S. is cutting a deal with Iran. So now they feel like, okay, we can't rely on the U.S. to protect the region. So now we have to sort of take things into hand ourselves and, do things ourselves. Mm.
Back in a sec, y'all. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one will be June 6th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. No way. Man, I hate that Flash player so much. You have no idea how much I hate the Flash player. Killing my audio. Killing audio that's got nothing to do with the Flash player. How do you like that? All right, let's see if I can get it to go now. Oh, you bastard. All right. It's all right. I'll just cue it up to 18 minutes on the restart. It'll be fine. It's going to work. That's my plan, is for it to work. Let's see here. Where's this thing? Well, it was the Adam Morrow interview, and then apparently Flash and Chrome, these guys can't email back and forth with each other to make sure that the dang plugin works with the stupid browser, huh, guys? And then you got to kill all my audio from all the rest of any other thing that I have going on this computer, huh? Is that it? Is that how you do your business? All right, let's see. 18 minutes, somewhere right around here. Let's try it. It's going to work. It doesn't work. For Christ's sake. Am I doing something else wrong? No. Crying out loud. God dang it, Bobby. Well, that's all right. I'll just restart the computer then. And then you'll get to hear most of the rest of that Adam Morrow interview. Geez, sorry about that, man. These things that happen, they do happen. Especially on live radio. It's no big deal. Anyway. By the way, that's okay because it gives me a chance to mention the article in Reuters today about, guess what the new petition is, the new activist drive, is to have the United Nations lift the immunity that United Nations peacekeepers have for when they rape children. Yes. As you can tell, kind of the implied premise of that discussion is that they have immunity that must be taken from them, because as it stands, UN peacekeepers can rape whatever children they want. This is a real thing. I even got a bumper sticker about it. I've had it for a long time. It says, "The United Nations selling children at reasonable prices since 1946. Because that's mostly what they do. They go around raping people's children. I mean, not that the children don't own themselves. They're raping children. Never mind their parents. Anyway. So, yeah, and they got real busted here in, was it in Central African Republic, right? For raping some kids. And, you know, this has happened before. You might remember back in the 1990s in Somalia, the peacekeepers were arrested for at least torturing. I'm not sure if rape was part of it. Certainly committing war crimes against Somali children. There's a picture, a famous picture of the UN peacekeepers holding a young boy over a fire in a metal barrel. And anyway, that was Canadians, Belgians, and Italians. And in all three cases, the UN tried to defend them and let them get away with it. But their home countries prosecuted their sorry asses anyway over the UN's dead body. And the UN said, hey, they have immunity. They work for us. We're the UN. We define what's a war crime and what's not. And since we're the UN, then that means ipso facto, like Nixon, if the president does it, it's not illegal. If the UN does it, it's not illegal. It's child rape for their own good, ultimately. The health of the United Nations is the health of mankind, right, everybody? So anyway, yes, that is a real thing. That is not some satire. There is a push to strip their immunity, because that's the kind of immunity that they have right now. The legal protection for being prosecuted for raping children. All you got to do, child rapists, is go and apply for a baby blue beret. And you can do whatever you want, you sick bastards. Oh, and it's baby blue. That means they mean well, and you can trust them. See what a soft, inviting color that is? Were you not in there on the focus group meeting there? Well, and of course the Americans have to do it all for them. I mean, I guess they have an Air Force. I'm sort of surprised.
Sorry, Scott, you're breaking up. Sorry.
Oh, I was just saying that, and of course the Americans are running the whole war for them as kind of a sop to the Saudis, I guess. Yes, we're doing a nuclear deal with Iran, but here we'll help coordinate. But, you know, it's all our AWACS and our battleships out at sea that are coordinating the war. And,
is that a fact? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the Wall Street Journal had a thing all about, I may be exaggerating a little bit on the solidity of the fact of the, you know, AWACS and ships. I don't think they're that specific, but, you know, basically, yeah. I mean, I need to go back and read that thing now and remember what all's in it and what all's from what I read elsewhere. But, you know, basically for the Saudis to do this without the Americans coordinating it, seems impossible to me. So I guess that's my problem, is I work off of that assumption in the first place, and then the Wall Street Journal just kind of, you know, they elaborated on some of it, basically. But
I think it's kind of a fair assumption, because the Saudis are in a situation where, you know, it's like money can only accomplish so much. You know, at a certain point, you actually have to be able to, like, field a fighting force, or be willing to put boots on the ground or that sort of thing. I mean, there's only so much that all of that Gulf money can do. I mean, you can buy a lot of shiny new weapons and aircraft and that sort of thing, but if you don't have the human resources and the personnel to fly the thing, if you don't have the expertise and the experience to actually operate and use the weapons at hand, then you have to rely on your patron.
Yeah, basically. And now, then again, remember, there's that whole thing where over Israel's dead body, Ronald Reagan went ahead and sold AWACS to Saudi anyway. So maybe they really do have their own AWACS and their own capability to control their airspace and that kind of thing. I'm under the impression they don't have much of a field army, but apparently they got a pretty good air force. But that does raise the question of Egyptian participation in this thing, because the Saudis, of course, they got way out ahead of themselves in announcing Pakistani participation before it ever really kicked in, and that was kind of a problem. But to what degree is the Egyptian military dictatorship going along with the Saudi war in Yemen? Do you know?
Well, I think they did. They made a major, major blunder in sort of assuming that these poorer nations could be coerced into sending troops, like Pakistan didn't. And I think they had originally hoped that Egypt would, and there was originally a lot of speculation. There might have been one or two, like, sort of reports that Egypt was planning to send ground troops. And those might have been test balloons, where they just sort of put that out there just to test public reaction. And I think it was decided that that sort of move, sending, you know, basically overthrowing the elected government and then sending Egyptian boys over to Yemen to get killed by Houthi militiamen, I think that they realized that that would have been political suicide. And it's like, there's no way this is going to play. Like we were talking about before, CC is already struggling with a popularity problem. And to throw that into the mix as well would have been devastating. So I think they came up with some kind of face-saving device. But at the end of the day, I mean, the Egyptian contribution to the whole Yemen campaign is limited. And there hasn't been any more talk of sending Egyptian ground troops. And there's also the idea that Egypt has a history with Yemen in the 1960s, where I think thousands of Egyptians were killed in the Yemen conflict during the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Egypt already has its own. In fact, I think it's referred to as Egypt's Vietnam. So Egypt already has this sort of complex about Yemen. So I think they just realized that it would just be totally politically unviable given the current circumstances. So they've scaled that back. You don't hear any more talk about Egyptians being deployed in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, just real quick, I Googled it, and the article that I was referring to, not that I had time to go back and reread it just now, but the article is called U.S. Widens Role in Saudi-Led Campaign Against Houthis in Yemen. But then what's funny is when I Googled it, just a little bit above in the search results is, in strategic shift, U.S. draws closer to Yemeni rebels. And this is from January 29th. And it begins, U.S. has formed ties with the Houthi rebels who seized control of the capital. And so here we are working with them because, hey, at least they're against al-Qaeda, right? And whatever. And this is just from January 29, 2015, it says. So now here we are a few months later. And after backing Saleh and backing Hadi and backing the Houthis, now we're backing the Saudi war for al-Qaeda and against the Houthis there.
Right. I'll tell you, any kind of, you know, analysis of Middle Eastern issues at this point has become so convoluted and difficult because of everything that's happened post Arab Spring, because of the total chaos.
All right, y'all. So that was the Adam Morrow interview recorded yesterday. You'll be able to hear the whole thing. There's another 10 minutes of it or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, almost 10 minutes worth. So check that out at scotthorton.org. It'll be up there tonight. Thanks, y'all, for listening. I'll see you tomorrow. Appreciate it. ScottHorton.org.